and thanks for joining us on a special edition of Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. How are the mayor and city council doing in holding the Chicago Police Department accountable for reform? And Chicago is seeing a drop in violent crime. A look at the reasons why and whether it can be sustained. Tonight, we kick off a year-long reporting project examining police and policing in Chicago. What's being done to repair police community relations, and what progress is being made on meeting the goals of the consent decree. That is the legal agreement to implement police department reforms. This reporting initiative is supported by the Joyce Foundation, and we kick off our coverage tonight with Nick Blumberg. Nick.
For the first time in 15 months, a key city council panel held a hearing into the Chicago Police Department's efforts to comply with a federal court order requiring it. But there was no sign any urgency surrounds the reform effort. Our Heather Sharone joins us now with more on the slow-moving and costly effort. Now, Heather, the consent decree took effect more than 6 years ago, but by the end of 2024, CPD was fully in compliance with just 16% of the requirements. Why has progress been so slow?
Well, consent decrees are complicated, legally binding agreements, and they're designed to take a three-step process to ensure systemic problems are eradicated and don't reoccur. So that is definitely part of the issue. But the other part of the issue is that it hasn't really gotten to the heart of the matter. It really is designed to do three things. One, set up a system for police officers to partner with Chicagoans to fight crime. Create a system to flag officers who've been accused of misconduct or who are otherwise struggling, and figure out if officers are deployed effectively and efficiently. None of those three things have happened yet.
Yeah, certainly a big lift there. Now, you know, back in 2020, City Council passed an ordinance requiring the Public Safety Committee to have regular hearings about CPD's progress with getting in compliance with the consent decree. But up until a few days ago, the last hearing hadn't taken place since February of 2024. Why?
I haven't really gotten any good answers about that, to be honest. But until recently, there was not a lot of good news to talk about with the consent decree. Up until the last 6 months of 2024, under Superintendent Larry Snelling and Mayor Brandon Johnson, progress had only inched up a couple of percentage points every 6 months. So now, this hearing had some good news to talk about, although there are plenty of reasons to be concerned.
So in March, you reported that there were more than 250 positions in the police department charged with implementing the consent decree that were sitting vacant. Has the PD made any progress in filling those jobs?
Well, the new executive director of CPD's Office of Constitutional Reform told Alder People about 50 of those positions have been filled. However, CPD has yet to respond, as required by state law, to a Freedom of Information Act that I've filed seeking the specific designations for each of the positions charged with implementing the consent decree. That would allow us here at WTTW News to use a city database to track precisely which positions are vacant and how long. We're still hoping they'll comply with that request.
Yeah, something I can imagine you're very eager to see, as are a lot of folks. Now, the consent decree is set to expand to include traffic stops. That's been a pretty significant source of controversy in recent months. Where does that effort stand?
In limbo. A public comment period expired earlier this month. That will likely prompt both CPD and the new Community Commission for Public Safety and Accountability to draft new rules. Where it goes after that is pretty much anybody's guess.
But I have a feeling you will be paying close attention.
Indeed, I will.
Heather Sharone, thanks very much.
Thanks, Nick.
And you can read Heather's full story on our website. That's all at WTTW.com/news.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Chicago's effort to bring down violent crime remains an ongoing battle, but shootings and homicides are down more than 30% through the first half of this year compared to the same time last year. And The police department says total violent crime is down by at least 22% this year. Our reporter Matt Masterson joins us now to break this down. Matt, so put these numbers into context for us. How do they compare to previous years?
Yeah, Brandis, these have been some pretty dramatic declines through the first half of 2025. You mentioned the 30% drops in shootings and homicides this year. Those equate to 500 fewer shootings, 600 fewer people shot, and about 100 people fewer killed this year than through the first half of 2024. So those are all significant declines over last year, not just back to pre-pandemic levels, but some of these drops are really historic. In April, there were 20 homicides recorded. That was the fewest for any single month in Chicago in a decade, and the fewest for any single April since the 1960s. In June, there were 34 homicides recorded. That was half the previous June from 2024, and again, the fewest in about a decade for any June. So this has been a trend nationally for declining violence in major cities, but in Chicago, it really has been substantial.
Okay, so holiday weekends, summer holiday weekends can be tricky in the city of Chicago. Mm-hmm. How was violence over this past 4th of July weekend compared to previous holiday weekends?
Yeah, more than 40 people were shot, 7 people were killed over the 3-day 4th of July weekend this year. That is down substantially from last year. It was a 4-day holiday weekend, but more than 100 people were shot. 19 people were killed in the city during that one. So 2025 did see a stark decline, but this is always a historically violent weekend. In 2023, there were 11 people killed, and 2022 was 8. So while this weekend, this year's holiday weekend, did see a drop in violence compared to last year, it was more along the recent historical trends. It didn't exactly match up with the rest of the year that has seen these significant declines.
Okay. The police department says that it has recovered 5,513 illegal firearms so far this year. What have city officials said about the role that illegal guns play in declining violence rates?
Yeah, it's a massive issue. The city has filed lawsuits against gun makers trying to take care of this with this violence level. Chicago police have recovered an average of, it's typically dozens a day. This year, in May, it was over 35 guns recovered per day. In June, it was around 32, but those numbers aren't significantly different than past years. There isn't a huge enforcement increase from the Chicago Police Department this year, but what the city is focusing on beyond just illegal firearms is community and social improvements. That's what they say has led to this decline this year in the shootings and homicides. Addressing unemployment, affordable housing, investing in youth, and addressing mental health resources for people in the city. That is what Mayor Brandon Johnson and other officials have said has really led to these declines this year.
Okay. All right. Matt Masterson, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brandon.
And you can read Matt's full story on our website. It's all at WTTW.com/news. As you just heard, Chicago is seeing a historic drop in violent crime in the first half of the year. According to the Chicago Police Department, homicides and shootings are both down more than 30% in the first 6 months of the year. That's compared to 2024. City data also shows significant declines in other categories as well, like carjackings, robberies, and aggravated assaults. While anti-violence advocates are pleased with current numbers, they believe, though, of course, there is still more work to be done. Joining us now with more are Jamal Cole, CEO and founder of My Block, My Hood, My City, a nonprofit that empowers underprivileged youth, Vaughn Bryant, executive director of the Metropolitan Peace Initiatives, and Tenny Gross, chief executive officer of Institute for Nonviolence Chicago. We also invited representatives of the Chicago Police Department to join us, but they declined. Gentlemen, thanks to the three of you for joining us.
Thank you.
First, I want to get your reaction when you hear that crime in Chicago is down as much as it is first half of this year compared to 2024, maybe previous years. What do you think when you hear that? Jamal, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I don't think it's really helpful to use a city's homicide rate as a reflection of our success or failure at reducing gun violence, because the geography of every community is different. So a domestic violence dispute that ends up at a homicide in Lakeview is a lot different from a drive-by shooting in East Garfield Park. So instead of tabulating all the homicides, like we have 1,200, 1,500, we need to be looking at what are people doing in these individual communities, and should those initiatives be expanded into broader strategies? How can we increase funding for the initiatives in these communities? That's all I think.
It makes me happy, but still cautiously optimistic because it can change. You know, it's unpredictable. But, you know, to know that there are 500 fewer victims, that's a good thing in my mind. And, you know, I also think that, you know, at least for our work, we've been at this consistently for 8 years. The city started funding us about 5 years ago, and I think that this is not something that happens overnight, but we have to, you know, keep at it because, you know, if we want to be the safest city, we still have a long way to go.
Tenney, same question to you.
I mean, I agree. You know, nationally we see reductions after the peak of a few years ago, but this is hard work going into it. You know, those of us who engage in the front line, I got woken up last night. My team was responding last night. So for us, it's a constant. But if it was going in the wrong direction, that's very discouraging. And we were there when they were going in the wrong direction during COVID, et cetera. So it feels good. There's a lot of mediations that go into it. I think the public thinks still it's a mystery. It's not. It's engaging. It's opportunities for young people. We want to see it continue.
To that point, you know, why do you think these numbers have decreased so dramatically?
Chicago, and I think the public doesn't know it, we've built together the largest civilian infrastructure in the United States now. There's, between staff and people on stipend, about 2,000 people, many of them with backgrounds, who are involved in peace operations. There is a significant investment in civilians to do this work. It worked in Boston, where I was in the 90s. It worked in other cities, L.A. We're doing it here, all of us, building on previous knowledge from Chicago as well. So that kind of belief that law enforcement has its part and civilian has its part is encouraging.
Vaughn, same question to you. Why do you think the numbers are down?
So I would agree with him, I guess, to build on what he's saying, that, you know, folks that we have on stipend, for example, our peacekeepers, those are guys who live in neighborhoods that we know, based on the data, live where shootings are happening. And we are, you know, training them to keep their particular block safe, and we have data from an external evaluator that tells us that those blocks are safer. And then the other thing is our outreach workers, you know, they're creating non-aggression agreements and they're working with groups to make sure that they, you know, are not attacking each other. And then that gives us the room to offer services like behavioral health services and like workforce development and helping people get GEDs. And so, you know, again, like you said, there's a lot of work that goes into it. And we have a workforce of people who are really working proactively to make our city safe.
Jamal, what do you think?
I agree. I think that it's just more people that are saying, hey, how can I start volunteering at Cook County Jail, at the Audi home, and how can I, hey, I remember when I used to think like that. Hey, I remember when I used to talk like that. And if you feel useful volunteering, I think that will sustain you in doing the work. So I think exposure for us is prevention. So they do a lot of type of prevention. It seems like they're doing prevention of retaliation. There's prevention with mental health. There's prevention with economics. We believe in primary prevention. Like, if you show kids better, they'll do better. So we take kids on exploration and expose them to different cultures, cuisines, and professions in Chicago.
Tenney, what's the strategy when you're approaching vulnerable individuals in some of these neighborhoods or communities?
My 35 years experience, and I started as an outreach worker in Boston during the crack epidemic, is I really believe in the young people. And we hire people from the community who know them, know those networks. We see the value in them when they don't see the way up, as Jamal was saying, right? They don't see yet the way out. That's only what they know. They're hopeless in terms of funding. So the mix of both supporting them with resources as well as guiding them in a positive way, exposing them. We would love to see that we will be unnecessary, that it really Jamal does all the work in the school. The young people don't drop out and don't get involved. But once they're involved, you got to pull them up, keep them safe for a while. And it's a process to get them back into a world that is more of a normal world.
Vaughn, of course, you know, improvements like this, they don't happen overnight, you know, like, because we were just talking about several years ago, the numbers were not like this. You said that you all have been doing this work for 8 years. What difference do you see in the work that you're doing now compared to some years ago?
I just would think we've grown. When we got started, it was mostly only privately funded, and then the state, you know, sort of got added to our mix, and then the city got involved, and then the county got involved, and then the state really got involved with RPSA and started investing heavily, and that, you know, allowed us to get to a point where we have 2,000 people. And there was, I think we tabulated that last year there was $74 million that went into the system of trying to keep us safe. So with that, with training the folks, the outreach workers, with training our case managers, with training our victim advocates. We actually do a cross-training with CPD. We do a cross-training with our hospital partners. So that way we have an ecosystem that is all working together and sharing information, you know, to make our city safer. And I just want to say, as far as the police are concerned, that's one way. Like, they give us information so that we can be proactive. We don't give them information. Because in order to keep our outreach workers safe and credible, you know, they have to have limited interaction with the police. So that is important.
It sounds like there's much more of a sort of an infrastructure around the work and sort of professionalizing it to a degree.
Right? Yeah,
I think the argument could be made there's more of that to be done.
Yeah, and it's local. Like, I take the Jamal's earlier point, like, we're looking at certain neighborhoods. We rank all 77 neighborhoods every year so that we know who's most violent. And so what's driving those numbers are South Lawndale, a little village. They're down like, you know, 40%+, but they had a really, really bad year last year. And then North Lawndale is down, you know, around mid-30s% as well. So, you know, those are historically violent neighborhoods. And so we got to be able to make a difference in where the violence is happening. And we believe in hyperlocality and making sure that it's the people in that neighborhood that we're employing to make it safe.
All of that said, you know, to a point that Jamal made earlier about, you know, domestic violence in Lakeview or Lincoln Park that leads to a homicide is very different from, mm-hmm. you know, a click, you know, or a turf beef that mm-hmm. leads to a homicide in another neighborhood. Because the safety gap, it has also narrowed, but it still remains staggering. This year, Black Chicagoans have been 19 times more likely than white Chicagoans to be the victim of a homicide. Mm-hmm. Jamal.
Yeah, I think the way poverty and segregation contribute to gun violence is poorly understood in Chicago. Gun violence is, to me, is a reflection of a few things. There's racial and economic injustice. There's high incarceration rates, high unemployment rates. You got poor neighborhoods, and you got under-resourced schools. When you have those five conditions, you get gun violence. Like, you have it's like making a cake or something. If you have one scoop of racial and economic injustice, two scoops of high incarceration, you stir it all up, you get gun violence. And so, we need to invest in programs that are working in East Garfield Park, in Inglewood, in Roseland, see if they should be expanded into broader strategies. That's what I would do.
Vaughn, we talked about funding. We know the Trump administration has eliminated grants to community-based violence prevention efforts as of 3 months ago, close to $30 million. Have you begun to notice any impact from this cut of funding?
Not yet. I mean, I think part of what we were doing with that funding was incubating smaller organizations. So there's people who, you know, you hear they're doing the work, they're volunteering. And we know sort of some of the reputable organizations out there that are doing incredible work, and we want to be able to build the infrastructure of their organization so that they can actually get public money and, you know, do more of what they're doing. And so that's how we were using the grant, and then we were also using it to train folks. But, you know, while we do need to have a strategy to replenish those funds, you know, that's why you have to be diversified so that you don't have an immediate disruption. But long term, you know, we'll have to figure out a way to replenish the funding that we were getting.
Jamal, have you begun to notice anything?
Yeah. I mean, if the mountain was smooth, nobody could climb it. My dad always says, if the mountain was smooth, nobody can climb it. So I expect it to be hard. This nonprofit world, the road is so narrow, you can't turn around sometimes, you know. And God has a battery in our back, so we do the work. But if we do think that investing in violence prevention is working, imagine how much more effective we would be if we would stop paying so much money in settling lawsuits and in violent policing. You know what I mean? It's like we're spending so much money. There's $100 million in the city budget for violence prevention, and we're spending like $160 million on settling lawsuits. I mean, if we want to invest more money in programming, we can look directly to that money and allocate it elsewhere.
So CPD has only fully complied with 16% of the consent decree in 6.5 years since it was ordered. Tenney, how do you think this slow progress impacts, you know, what is an already strenuous or tenuous, actually, relationship between the police department and the community?
I mean, I worked with police departments since the 90s in Boston, observing them, and those changes are painful. They're not easy. These are bigger bureaucracies. They're important to happen. Taxpayers in all 77 neighborhoods deserve to be policed in an equal way, right? So if the efforts now, from what I hear, the superintendent is making progress, I think we want to cheer him on that, and we want to keep pushing because it is important. We don't think we're a substitute. to other systems as well. We want schools to be well, treating our young people, every system that they come for. And policing is where a lot of our young people come in contact with. So, and for the sake of officers, it is a stressful job. They see a lot of horror. So we need to keep encouraging. We cannot say, all right, this is an old story. We got to stay involved to make sure that the civilians and those who work in law enforcement get the right system.
So as we've discussed, violence is down, but it's still a problem because there was a drive-by shooting that took place earlier this month in River North, killing 4 people, leaving 14 wounded just last night. I wonder if this is the phone call that woke you up, where 4 teens were wounded in West Garfield Park. Vaughn, how do shootings like that impact the perception of progress?
I mean, I think it lets us know that, you know, even though there's progress, there's still a problem. And it's why we don't rest. Like, we, you know, celebrate short, but, you know, get out there and continue to work because, again, you know, one life lost is one life too many, and we have plenty of that still going on, and there's still much work to be done. And, you know, when we started this, we said it would take us about 10 to 15 years to really get where we need to go, and we're just halfway there, so we still got a long way to go.
Are these numbers sort of evidence of progress in that goal?
We hope so. We hope so. Like, because it is happening nationally, like, to me, that gives me a little pause because we do believe in hyperlocality. We know what we're doing in our neighborhood, but we don't know what is driving it nationally, and I think there's more information to be gained, and we just have to use our data to continue to work harder ourselves.
Jamal, you know, you mentioned, you know, comparing the budget that the city spends on overtime, or not overtime, excuse me, but on community intervention or violence intervention work compared to what they spend settling lawsuits and, mm-hmm. and how much is budgeted for that. What else do you think is being done to reach this point in addition to the community violence intervention, as well as what else should be done to maintain it?
Yeah, I was just saying, if we are going to invest in decreasing street violence, we need to invest in decreasing state violence. And that starts with holding police accountable and redirecting some of those funds from settlements to services that we're doing. And as far as the violence that's happening in communities, I tell teenagers all the time, like, set big goals, like Vaughn here. Like, this dude is in the league. Like, when you set goals like that, I'm not getting in a car with you, man. I'm going to the league. Like, the universe creates a force field around you when you got big goals. If it's not waking you up at 5 a.m., it's not big enough. And if you got a friend, you say, hey, what are you doing this weekend? And they say, I'm maintaining. Run. I don't want to be next. I'm not hanging out with you just maintaining. I want to hang out with somebody that wants to go to Duke University, that wants to be an astronaut. Like, that's the kind of, like,
that's the league.
That's the league. Find your own league. You know what I mean? And so that's what I tell kids. Yeah.
Tandy, same question to you. What else could be done, and what has been done to help get to this point?
I think the investments are really good. The rest of the country is looking at Chicago. So something we can pat ourselves on the back a little bit is you have private foundations, 50 of them. You got the business community. You got all levels of government investing in this. That is beautiful, right? That is. I don't take it for granted. I worked in an environment where we didn't have that. I would like to see more programming for young people on the weekends and at night. You know, when you're 17, you're looking for a date. You're looking for fun, right? We are robbing our young people from their childhood. So investing more in that in the neighborhood. They can enjoy downtown as well. I think rather than thinking someone brought up curfews and that, let's be consistent, invest in young people in positive programming. They are thirsty for it, really. The hanging out is the second best alternative for them, right? I was yesterday visiting 2 young men in Englewood. One was shot recently. They rather have a job. They're 17, you know, they also want a date, et cetera. They want to hang out. And I told them, it's tragic that for you sometimes going to a party could be the end, so, and that you have to make choices about that. You shouldn't. In many other places, you don't.
Almost out of time, gentlemen. Vaughn, you know, in this time of budget cuts, what supports, resources does your organization still need?
We still need more funding. We still have organizations that had to lay some people off. And so continuing to be able to support, you know, the local organizations that are trying to do this work, I think that's the most important thing. And then also, you know, continuing to invest, you know, private money, because that gives us some flexibility to innovate, because this work still needs to be innovative. And I think the areas that we need more coordination and more sort of structure is like housing. Housing stability leads to better ability to sustain a job, and then our reentry services and doing more in-reach to make sure that the transition home is good. So those 3 areas, housing, reentry, And workforce development are like the major areas that we need to be focused on.
All right. I think that's a good place for us to leave it, gentlemen. Thank you for joining us, for the work that you do. Jamal Cole, Vaughn Bryant, and Tenny Gross, thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks as well to the Joyce Foundation for their support in our police reporting initiative. And that's our show for this Monday night. Be sure to sign up for our free email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan, at WTTW.com/newsletter. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and at a special time, 11. Some local hospitals are paring down gender-affirming health care for minors. Well, look at the impact. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm working to preserve the dignity and rights of all individuals.